Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Claudia Rankine is a brilliant writer and one of the most important thinkers in America today. Her work pushes the boundaries of genre and form, combining poetry, essay, criticism, and visual imagery. Her book-length poem, Citizen, an American Lyric, was a New York Times bestseller for months, which is incredibly rare for poetry. Her readings and talks often attract thousands of attendees. Citizen has fueled a national conversation on what it means to be a Black person in America right now. As the Times put it, quote, "The challenge of making racism relevant, or even evident, to those who do not bear the brunt of its ill effects is tricky. Rankine brilliantly pushes poetry's norms to disarm readers and circumvent our carefully constructed defense mechanisms against the hint of the possibility of being racist ourselves." Rankine appeared as part of our Portland Arts and Lecture Series on February 8, 2018 at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Her talk attempts to put the 2017 presidential election into a historical, social, and institutional context by looking at it through the lens of race. Here's Rankine.
Good evening. I'm going to talk about whiteness. Why not? The days following the election, wherever I went, people behaved as if someone had died. Every response was mediated in order to dial back unfounded hope in our immediate future. People were stern about their grief. It was made clear no one should look away from our new reality. Bewilderment existed in some, disgust brimmed over in others. Many anticipated the result of the election. Many felt it was an inevitability currently unveiled. Many hadn't known the reality existed or could exist. Given the voting statistics gathered after the election, some felt on the right side of things, but others were handing out hugs and donning safety pins to make clear their political affiliations. "I'm as well as one can be," was the phrase I repeatedly encountered. I heard it in elevators, stores, taxis, on personal phone calls, until it was coming out of my own mouth. It was the best we Americans could do to signal our profound recognition of who and what we also were. I have pictures, I have slides, I'm gonna use them. Seven months earlier, I, like many others, worried that a candidate with overt white nationalist sympathies would be our next president. Having just accepted a position at Yale, I submitted a proposal for a course on the constructions of whiteness. All year I read historians and theorists, everyone from Matthew Fry Jacobson and Nell Painter to Richard Dreyer and Lauren Ballant, and how whiteness functions in American culture. The readings both organize events in chronological sequence and theorize much of what we all intuitively knew. I've read books on white spaces, white male rage, and the role of white femininity in American culture. I studied comedy routines from Saturday Night Live. You remember that? Key and Peele, Louis C.K. There are commercials that play to our American aspirations. I wish to build a syllabus that showed not only what the culture was saying, but also what it was seeing. My teaching assistants and I gathered images that reflected or complicated the arguments being made by the culture about what whiteness looks like and stands for. We pored over Whitney Dow's The Whiteness Project, which if you haven't seen it, you can just go online. He's the same person who did the two Jaspers after the black man was lynched by car in Jasper, Texas. He then went around the country and interviewed people who are white or white passing about what it's like to be white in American culture. This guy that you're seeing in the center of the screen, he is white passing but Mexican American, like actually C.K. Lewis. And he talked about what it felt like being with his white friends and hearing them talk about Mexicans in really derogatory ways. And he said, you know, it was sometimes difficult for him to hear his mother being referred to inside of that category. He disassociated himself from the comments that were being made, but felt bad for his mom. We also looked at Christian Lauder's blog, The Stuff White People Like. I mean, the list is funny sometimes and sometimes interesting. We put phrases into Google search to see what the algorithms would pull up. And this is a page capture. What we put in was boys being boys. And the only person apparently allowed to be a boy is what you see in front of you. And in the spirit of Benjamin Eleanor Adam, we did Google searches for the phrase evolution, which tended to portray the height of evolution as the body of a white male, thus relating whiteness and humanity, an association that has its roots in racial science, eugenics, the ethical justifications of colonialism, slavery, and genocide. I was not intending in the class an exhaustive introduction to the subject of whiteness, but rather a reading and viewing experience that could generate discussions in mixed race company that need not pause for the good manners of social life that excluded any form of discomfort. The goal was, well, what was it? To foster current timely response to the idea that whiteness and white dominance were constructed, to show how it wasn't enough to say that it's all white studies unless otherwise marked. As their black professor, I was perhaps a little desperate to communicate to my students that they weren't in the class to help me have a better life. Fred Moten was the jarring music in my head. Fred Moten, in case you don't know who he is, he's a fantastic theorist and poet. And he said this, he wrote this in a book that he co-edited with Stefano. He said, I don't need your help. I just need you to recognize that the shit is killing you too, however much more softly. Over 100 students arrived the first day for a class that could hold a quarter of that number. So obviously it's a subject they want to talk about. We were a little over 2 months before the presidential election. When I asked each of them to write a letter explaining why it was important to consider the role of whiteness in our culture, the letters both framed the students autobiographically and also attempted to explain American culture and its deep racial divides. There were students of every ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation. Some had mixed race parents. Some knew their family members to be racist. Some felt victimized by the effects of white dominance, while others felt guilt. All wanted us as a country to do better, though I wondered if their desire to be in the class already indicated a level of pessimism. Every letter seemed equally convincing as to why that student should take the class, and consequently, the class was made up of the first 25 who had emailed their response. We began the semester with the students articulating their own understanding of how the concept of race developed in America. It's a byproduct of colonialism, many of the historically minded said. One student wrote a fairy tale. Once upon a time, the white people lived in the daylight, and the people of color lived at night. Then one day, the whites decided they needed the time, or some more time, or all the time. I don't recall the student's exact wording, but I do remember the feeling in class that she had captured a truth by calling to mind language like darky, the dark continent, the enlightenment, heart of darkness, and so on. All the talk about darkness was an invitation to begin our semester-long discussion with curiosity about why we perceive others the way we do. There I am in class, just to prove to you I'm not making it up. So one of the first things we looked at were Shirley cards, which are reference cards used to determine exposure and color balance in film, especially for skin tone. And I will...
This is a Shirley card. And if you developed color film between the 1940s and the 1990s, the accuracy of the colors in your photos were pretty much based on this skin tone.
Shirley was probably the name of the first person who was pictured on the cards, and Shirley became the subsequent name of all the women pictured on the cards.
That's Lorna Roth, a professor and researcher at Concordia University in Montreal.
Usually they were white women who wore very colorful dresses.
Color film works like this. There are layers of chemicals stacked on each other that are sensitive to different colors of lights. And there are a series of different types of chemical solutions that are used to develop them once exposed to that light. A combination of all of these chemicals creates a film's color balance. And for many decades, chemicals that would bring out various reddish, yellow, and brown tones were largely left out.
The consumer market that was designated in the design of film chemistry was that of the lighter skinned market. So when it came to defining what an idealized international skin tone would be, it turned out to be a lighter skin tone than a darker skin tone. If you're shooting people with lighter skins, it looks good. If you're shooting people with darker skins, it doesn't look so good. If you're shooting mixed race in the same screen, then we see the real problems.
It wasn't until the 1970s where things started to change, and it came from a very unlikely source.
Companies that were advertising different kinds of wood furniture were complaining that Kodak film did not render the difference between dark-grained wood and light-grained wood.
The other companies that Kodak responded to were chocolate makers, because the film couldn't render the difference between dark chocolate and milk chocolate. As the film and television industries became more diverse, color balance issues at the professional level became even more apparent. And in the 1990s, a team of designers at Philips and Breda Holland tackled the issue head-on by developing a camera system that used two different computer chips to balance lighter and darker skin tones individually.
First people to buy these cameras for television, they were called the LDK series, were Oprah Winfrey and Black Entertainment Television, like people who were very aware of these issues.
So you get the idea. 1990s. Chocolate and furniture. Not until wood furniture manufacturers needed accurate representation of wood grain for marketing purposes was precise color balance available to people of color. The class was able to link this to the popular use of bleaching creams in Asia and Africa. Many of the students had already seen the recent offensive Asian commercials where a black man was run through the washer to reemerge clean and white. I don't know if you caught that. We have imported the value of whiteness all over the world. So the semester's first shared text whiteness of a different color presented Matthew Fry Jacobs an argument that one of the country's earliest attempts to equate citizenship with whiteness came with the Naturalization Act of 1790, which limited voting rights to free white Anglo-Saxon men. Given that black people were still named property, this hold on self-governance was situated against others now commonly understood to be white: Irish, Jews, Poles, Greeks, etc. The Immigration Act, or more specifically the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, made it clear, as Jacobson explained, that Europeanness, that is to say whiteness, was among the most important possessions one could lay claim to. The Act maintained the quota system based on nationality and declared Arabs and Asians completely barred from immigrating to the United States. So we see our present policies have precedent. Jacobson's work helped the students understand how racial difference was a political and cultural construct that has always been determined by white men in our country. His text also gave them a timeline for the development of the white supremacist terror group, the KKK. The presidential campaign had created a platform more recently for their voice. Everyone in the class was aware of the KKK and the tenets of white supremacy. What we didn't know was that these white nationalists came into formation after the Civil War and worked in tandem with the legislative black codes. That's Jacobson's book, if you're interested. It's called Whiteness of a Different Color. He's my colleague at Yale. This image is an image I'm really interested in. It's 1920s. And so we think about the March on Washington as something that is sort of the epitome of resistance in the United States. But this is one of our first marches on Washington. After the Civil War, you probably know, the black codes were put in place to prevent black people from integrating into American society. And basically, the black codes institutionalize the terrorism of the KKK. So that was the institutional action, and then the KKK was, you know, walked around lynching, burning African Americans, which were intended to take rights away from newly freed blacks by keeping them out of the economy and government. Bryan Stevenson, whose book you might have read, Just Mercy, he says that the North might have won the war, but the South won the narrative. The narrative where black people are not people. The KKK's second reign of terror occurred between 1915 and 1940 in response to the immigration of Catholics, hence the burning of crosses. According to Jacobson, this expansion of their attention moved their stronghold from the South to the Midwest and the West. So here, the KKK was moved across the Midwest into the West to places. Here, I mean, you guys, you were a sundown state back in the 1840s. Black people not allowed to live here at all. And if they worked here, they had to be out of town before the sun went down. Not until the 1950s, with the beginning of the civil rights movement, did white nationalists stop fighting among themselves for the purity of their whiteness and turn their attention as socially constructed Caucasians. So before the Civil Rights Act, you had Anglo-Saxon whites terrorizing Catholics and Irish, and then you had, you know, and Jews, and you had people changing their names and having surgery in order to assimilate into whiteness, because everybody understood that whiteness was property. There's a great essay by Cheryl Harris, the attorney, in the Harvard Law Review, entitled Whiteness as Property. And it was something that you could own, and any way you could get it, you got it. You changed your name, you married into something, someone that was considered more white, We saw with the Trump family, everybody turned blonde suddenly. So whatever one had to do to present white purity, you did it. But that infighting stopped with the civil rights movement, and all of these various ethnic groups became Caucasian. And that's how whiteness became a thing. You left your country in Europe as an Italian, as somebody of Irish descent, and you arrived on the shores of the United States and you became Caucasian and white. The 20th century, and this is a quote, the 20th century reconsolidation of the 19th century's Celts, Slavs, Hebrews, and Mediterraneans to the terrorization, they turned to the, as a collective group of whites, to the terrorization of American blacks and minorities from non-European countries. This attention was complete, and the terror occurred physically in the forms of shooting, lynchings, fire hoses, and dogs, and institutionally in terms of legislative policies affecting education, housing, and the justice system. And I think that's the part that we like to forget, that the actions of the KKK were supported institutionally. The class considered the rhetoric of making America great again, not just in terms of its political aspirations towards white nationalism, but also in terms of the cultural framing that was done in 19th and 20th century photographers like Carlton Watkins and Ansel Adams, whose images reflected in monumental scale an American landscape that supported notions of white greatness and white ownership in this country. I'm a real downer today, I know. Every class discussion was ghosted by the underground consideration of what it means for Americans to aspire to white dominance. The theorist Lauren Bollant's cruel optimism helped us think about the condition of maintaining an attachment to a significantly problematic object. The separation of whiteness and white dominance from individuals and individual groups, and its placement back in the culture as a systemic and originating historical dynamic, was aided by the rhetoric of the new administration. But even as we spoke about this, one student asked why the syllabus didn't reflect more historical examples of individual white benevolence. Now looking back, I might have handled discussions touching on white abolitionists and civil rights activists differently, but in the moment I was bemused by the student's wish for me to turn my attention away from the problems of systemic white dominance in order to create a more palatable narrative for her. And though I was also trying to be vigilant against narrowing my gaze to the overwhelming debts contributing to black grievance, I couldn't think of a good example of systemic and sustained white advocacy for blacks in a culture with the trajectory of slavery to Jim Crow to the warehousing of blacks in prisons. I, perhaps out of desperation, pointed out that we had read Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia as an example of a complicated advocacy for black freedom by a founding father. And, you know, Jefferson is a fascinating example because he is somebody who spent a lot of time talking about the fact that black people should be freed, that slavery was not a good idea. And yet, he never freed his slaves. And he didn't free them because he liked to shop. He would go to France and Paris and buy wine and books and paintings, and he would come back and owe so much money that his house belonged, Monticello belonged to the bank, and the slaves were part of that. He was eventually offered money by a European to free his slaves, and he refused that too, because he needed the staff. He said at one point that if the slaves were freed, they should be shipped out of the United States. Because if they ever realize what white people had done to them, there would never be peace in this country. If you want to find that quote, it's in Notes on the State of Virginia. The students used the term white privilege with an ease and frequency that suggested they had stopped interrogating how deeply its connotations shaped white consciousness, or the white unconscious. The phrase brought forward in 1988 by the Wesley professor Peggy McIntosh, I'll show you a picture of her. There she is. She wrote a piece called White Privilege and Male Privilege, a personal account of coming to see correspondence through work in women's studies. McIntosh enumerated 46 ways in which white privilege gets enacted. She wrote that piece because she threw a conference and she invited some black female academics. When the black female academics said to her, "Hey, this conference doesn't really address any of our concerns," she said to them, "My God, you're so ungrateful." And then she caught herself and she went back and said, "Oh my God, what am I doing?" And so she sat down and wrote out these 46 ways in which white privilege makes white dominance seem a desired thing. That's the list, white privilege, unpacking the invisible backpack. McIntosh would subsequently disown the term white privilege because the word privilege makes white dominance seem a desired state. I told the student I personally preferred Robin DiAngelo's term, internalized dominance. It's the same thing as talking about the South winning the narrative. That white people, whether or not they understand it consciously, they believe they are better than everyone else. And the way we know that happens is if either they're in the camp of our president and they think people should go, or they think of black people as a burden that they should be working on. DiAngelo states, for the dominant group, being socialized to see the minoritized group as inferior necessarily conveys that the dominant group is superior. This sense of superiority is often not explicit, but internalized deep beneath the surface. The process causes members of the dominant group to see themselves as normal, real, correct, and more valuable, thus more entitled to the resources of society. The thing, the Robert Wood Johnson, you know when you listen to NPR and they say, "This program is brought to you by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation." They did a, they interviewed a bunch of white people and they asked them if they felt they were discriminated against. And over 50% of them said yes. And they asked them, what are examples of this discrimination? And they couldn't give them examples. But what I think it is that if a white person sees a black person like, let's just pull one out, Barack Obama, in a position that they think a white person shall hold, then that white person has taken something away from them. And, you know, that's why diversity offices have to now exist in institutions. Because the habits of the institution is that whatever places or whoever should be employed should continue to look like the people that have been employed in those spaces. And without a consciousness of bringing other people in, the habits will reinstate themselves because people feel comfortable. And they think, I feel comfortable with that person, so that means that's a good hire. But that comfort might indicate the sameness of that person. D'Angelo is also responsible for introducing the phrase white fragility, which he defines as a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves in white people. Barack Obama, let's bring him back. These reactions can end discussions or lives. And we've seen this again and again with police shooting unarmed black people and then claiming that they felt fear. This fragility, D'Angelo argues, stems from the inability of individual whites to understand that racism encompasses economic, political, social, and cultural structures, actions, and beliefs that systematize and perpetuate an unequal distribution of privileges, resources, and power between white people and people of color. This is why I found the students' requests for examples of good white people beside the point of the class. The insistence on individual benevolence allows whites not to see themselves as part of a systemized dynamic of supremacy defining our American lives. When I arrived in the classroom the Monday following Trump's victory, my students said nothing. Instead, they sat uncharacteristically silent and waited for me to speak. I looked around the room and decided to express my personal fear, the fear that seemed to me behind our newly programmed responses. Things are about to get bad in ways we will and will not see, I said. I could think of nothing else to add. The week's reading, perhaps ironically, was on the white imagination. Linda Martin Ockroft's The Future of Whiteness considered the bounds of our collective pessimism about racism, and in particular about white racism. She wrote about white exceptionalism, as she defined as the idea that whiteness is so distinct as a form of social identity and so problematically tied to its supremacist illusions that it cannot be redeemed. The question for the class as a group and for each of us individually was, what would it mean to redeem whiteness? Was that even the right question? The election was over and Jill Stein's eventual recount efforts and reported connections to Russia were not going to save us. The weight of the darkness felt palpable in and outside the classroom. Many, let's define many as the popular vote, were thrown into what historian Jelani Kopp called a malaise, but what I will call a national depression. What devastated us was not that a Republican won the election. This had happened many times in our individual and collective lifetimes, and it did not send us to bed, give us migraines, stomach cramps, bring tears to our eyes, or any of the other physical reactions that were expressed. To me, never before had we rated our sewing boxes for safety pins as a visual mark of separation from self-identified white nationalists, despite having lived through the likes of Bull Connor, George Wallace, Strunk Thurmond, Forest Hill in Boston, the Reagan years, and many other public officials and historical moments defined by racist, homophobic, or xenophobic viewpoints. What was different this time, what floored the popular vote, lifelong Republicans and those looking on from many other countries, was that the country that had been perceived as a destination for so many since its inception, the country calling for liberty and justice, was now calling for the return to a pre-civil rights era, was now calling for the deportation of people living peaceful lives in America, was now calling for the stripping of rights for women and the repealing of health insurance for many. The new administration did not believe in the science of climate change or the rights and status of permanent residency, transgender rights, or a woman's right to choose, or the First Amendment, to give a cursory example. We were now going to rule by law. And what rule by law means, I had a long discussion with a constitutional lawyer about this, and what we're having now is a government that will find in the loopholes legal ways to deport people. So it says, you are a permanent resident as long as you have never gone to jail. But it says in there somewhere in your record that you got some kind of parking ticket and you forgot to pay the fine. Grounds for deportation. Those are the kinds of things that are happening now. In short, we had voted in a bullying machine intent on rerouting the arc of history from the heretofore inconstant and uneven promise of inclusion to a defensive and exclusionary stance. Angry white men, American Masculinity at the End of the Era, by Michael Kimmel, proved especially impactful given its subject is white men who in part historically have determined the direction of our country has taken and would take next. You know, white men are 30-something percent of the population. They hold over 70% of elected office. So 35% or 30-something percent of the population is ruling the population. And you can see it if you just look at pictures of Congress. Kimmel interviews a cross-section of men who express beliefs like, we're going down the f***ing toilet, that's what I mean, just look around, there's illegals everywhere, there's Wall screwing everybody, we got a f***ing nigger in the White House, we're all screwed. The students felt they knew versions of these men, ones who knew better than to use the N-word, perhaps, but whose grievances sailed close to the racist, xenophobic, and sexist concerns of their America, ones who felt alienated from a culture persecuting them with political correctness. Kimmel insists white male rage knows no class and is tied to notions of masculinity and entitlement. And voting patterns for this election prove that. White men making over $100,000 a year and up voted for Trump. So we can't use the Marxist argument that this is about being outside of economic trajectories. What has been interesting, during Obama years, suicide rates for white men went up. They got higher than for black men. Hispanic men have always been on the bottom, but suddenly white men began to commit suicide more than anyone else. So it'll be interesting to see if under Trump that decreases now. All right, so I have 2 minutes. I'm just going to jump to the end of this paper. And basically what the end says is that the midterm elections are coming, baby. After September 11th, Louis Lampun wrote, "No sum of historical justification can excuse the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But neither can we excuse our own arrogance behind the screens of shock and disbelief. Enthralled by an old script, we didn't see the planes coming because we didn't think we had to look. It seems old habits die hard. Though Trump's run-up to power began with the birther movement, I'm starting to think he was not born here," he said. "With its white supremacist challenge to President Obama's citizenry, many Americans will insist supremacists, they didn't see his presidency coming. We might ask ourselves why we weren't looking. And now that we are here, I hear the sentiment that it's good to have the hypocrisy of the veiled white supremacist agenda of our country uncovered and out in the open. But if this moment is indeed a movement towards illumination and change, then this change involves trauma, loss, dislocation, anti-Semitism, anti-Arab legislation, anti-transgender and homophobic legislation, and good old white supremacist racism. The real question of the moment is not how powerful are we, but how powerless are we? How irredeemable are we? Is it possible to create a path towards what has never existed but fueled our beliefs? Is citizenship truly what we aspire to? Going forward, we have to live with our citizenry as our identity. We are all connected. As a naturalized citizen, I am as connected to the ones who say, "Go back to where you came from," as I am to the ones who say, "You are safe." It occurs to me now that what I should have said to my students the week after the election was that what will be done in this administration will be done in our name. This is not the time for impotency. Civic action is suddenly synonymous with living. The midterm election is the thing to focus on. Thank you very much.
We're going to start with some questions from Woodburn High School. So I just encourage you now to write your questions on those cards and hand them to the ushers, and we'll get started with a few questions from them. What obstacles have you encountered as a female poet of color, and what within you helped you overcome them?
Obstacles. You know, I know that I have been subject to the same kinds of racist rhetoric that many black women have been subject to, and black people in general. But I've also felt pretty lucky in my life. So for every person who was like, no, there was always a person who was yes. I think that the worst thing that could happen to a writer is that they're not allowed to write what they want to write. That somebody tries to narrow the focus of their work. And in order to stop that from happening, you have to be willing to walk. And for whatever reason, I have always been willing to walk. So when people have said no to me, I have said goodbye. And that has happened a number of times. So it's not that people will not try and say no. People will say no. When I wrote Don't Let Me Be Lonely, my publisher dropped me. They said, this is not poetry. I said, this is what I got. It's also what I mean. And I found another, I found Grey Wolf, which I love. So it was one of those happy accidents or happy intentional dismissals that landed me in the right place. So, you know, you just never know. You never know. But I've also had, you know, a lot of good people in my life.
What has been the most difficult topic or piece to express to your readers?
What is the most difficult? I mean, like, you know, reading this paper on whiteness, I always find it a little bit like, oh, I wish I had a joke to tell you. because it is a lot of information, and I didn't even give you the half of it. And it's the onslaught of the constant exclusionary policies, brutal exclusionary policies of this country You know, we could have talked about the bombing of Tulsa. There's so much we could have talked about in terms of what this government has done to shore up whiteness and to eradicate other people. So I, you know, even as I'm up here saying these things, I'm just like, oh my God, oh my God. So I find that a little bit a pain for me. And I don't mean a pain in the, I just mean a pain. I mean, it's painful. It's painful that the narrative that we've been given about this country only works for a portion of it.
What surprised you the most from that whiteness class?
I think what I wouldn't have expected going in was there were a number of black women who had white mothers. And these are women who presented as black women. They were mixed, like my daughter. My husband is white. So they're mixed. But when you see them, you think, oh, there's a black woman. And none of the students had any problem outing their dads as racists. You know, they're like, my father says this kind of thing, and my grandfather says this kind of thing. But those women had a hard time talking about their mothers. And it was sort of really interesting to watch them negotiate these women who will always be valued in the society more than their daughters will be. And they would come to my office and say, I want to write about my mother X or my mother Y, but none of them did it. They all changed the topics by the end for the final paper. But the ones that were going to talk about their father's racism, they all did it. So I was really interested in that dynamic.
Can you talk about the process of how you structured is underlined here, citizen?
Citizen begins with microaggressions. And, you know, people often say, why don't you just call them racist acts? But they are moments that don't kill you, and they accumulate to the moments that do kill you. The police, where the people are being shot or killed or abandoned, like in Katrina. And the reason I structured it in that way was because I was really disturbed by people who would say things after Katrina or after the killing of Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or Freddie Gay. They would say, how did this happen? And I was like, what are you talking about? How did this happen? Yesterday you said something racist. So it happened because it is part of the fabric of this culture. It happened because as Americans we said it's okay for dead people to lie in the street for hours uncovered, as was the case with Michael Brown. We did not flood the streets and say, this is unacceptable. We did not get on juries and say, those policemen should be held accountable. So it happens because we do not see black people as people. And so I wanted to show how the commons are just part of the larger structure that confirms mass incarceration and the breakup of the black family as part of day-to-day living in American society.
You referenced James Baldwin's writing, and this is a quote, the purpose of art is to lay bare the questions hidden by the answers. What are the big questions you are currently thinking about?
That's a good question. Right now, if I were not here right now, I would be in New York, in rehearsal for my play, The White Card, which opens on the 28th in Boston. And that play is an attempt to stage a conversation about race that holds the pitfalls that we encounter when we try and talk about whiteness. and the role of whiteness in the lives of so many of us. And so that, you know, that has been what I've been thinking about in the last 2 years. It's been interesting to have the actors now with the standing up in the language and embodying the text of the play. And so we open in 2 weeks, so we'll see. But that's what I'm thinking about. Thank you so much.
That was Claudia Rankin speaking as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.